Frodo. Welcome to Frodo and Bilbo country. Carol made the announcement that for their birthday, which as you know is September 22nd. How many of you how many of you have read the books? All or part? Oh, jeez. Who am I? I'm talking to people who are experts then. Is there anybody who hasn't read the books? I forgot to look at the hands. Okay. The rest of you can leave. So I can tell lies. It comes in a box set, first of all. You can get, this is Lord Rings, and The Hobbit makes the fourth. And I think what I'd like to do, listen to that fire. Holy mackerel. I think what I'd like to do is kind of talk in a general kind of way about the books. And what I want to do is kind of build up your imagination a little bit and try to stimulate you to read them. If you've already read them, then what I'm going to say is probably going to bore the devil out of you. So if you want to leave, feel free. It's okay. Because you're going to be hearing elementary things, and you're going to say, I know all that. I know all that. So feel free to chime in and say, put in your 2 cents worth. But let me proceed as if nobody had read, okay? Okay, says Jack to himself. Tolkien was a Middle English and an Old English scholar in Oxford, and wrote this some 30 years ago. And The Hobbit was the first book, and then he wrote the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And I think the best thing to do is to look upon this as a quest. You know, quest literature, can you hear me back there, by the way? My throat's going fast. It's been going since August 1st and sliding downhill. The quest motif is probably one of the largest motifs in literature. I think you can look at almost any work of literature as a quest. Whether it's Babbitt and what his quest was, or Madame Bovary had a quest, or Heart of Darkness is a quest. The Iliad, the Odyssey are quests, certainly. And there are classic quests, and epic quests, and folk quests. And then somehow or other, in there somewhere is Tolkien, and Bilbo, and Frodo, and the boy. A quest is where you go to do something, right? You've got to leave home, you shut the door behind you, and you go out on the road because something needs doing. Something has to be fixed. And you're elected. You're the only guy that can do it. Jason and the Golden Fleece, Ulysses, great Homeric epic kinds of quests where it's the Ulyssean figure, the strong he-man who's tough, and everybody knows he's the toughest man in the regiment, so he gets the job to go do this and fix it up, right? And you leave your house and you go out on the road and you're never sure of where that road's going to go, but you know you got to go. You can look upon war as a quest if you want to. You serve time in the Army or the Navy or whatever. You leave home, you leave your city, you go where it is. And one of the sad things about the quest is that almost invariably, things are not the same when you're done. Things have changed. Sometimes, more often, you've changed. You're not the same person. You come home, you fought the war, for example, and you come home and these hobbits, for that's what they're called, live in a place called the Shire. And when the whole thing is completed and Frodo can come home again, it's not the same. He's been wounded physically and psychologically, and the psychological wound is always the worst. So I'll just take a look for a minute at some of the things in the quest, and it'll be interesting a little bit. The quester must either get something or leave something. In this case, for those of you who have not read the book, the something is a ring. This one right here, I have it now. And when you put this baby on, you disappear. I can remember wishing I had such a ring. Yes. What could I do with a ring? Like that. Mercy. Oh, yeah. I loved having it. Well, this doesn't make me disappear. I put this on. But there is such a ring. And it's a very evil ring. And it's got to be destroyed. That's what the whole story centers about. And they live, Tolkien has created a thing called Middle Earth. It's not today, it's not yesterday, it's not even 1,000 years ago. We don't know exactly when Middle Earth was, but it's a long time ago when men lived in harmony with hobbits. And hobbits are little people, little halflings. who like five meals a day, and they're cheery folk, and they like good ale, and they have curly hair on their toes and leather soles on their feet, and they like bright colors, especially orange and green and yellow. They like pipeweed, they like to smoke, and the one thing they don't like is adventures. The one thing a hobbit can do without is an adventure. And lo and behold, the greatest adventure of all Middle Earth comes to these hobbits, and they don't want any part of it. But very often in a quest, you're not given that choice, right? So you go, I want the whole company to take two steps backwards, and BFC, Klutz, and it's you do it, it's your number. Well, this is essentially what happens to Frodo. Remember the fairy tales that you've read when you were kids, where somebody had to do something, had to perform something, or bring something back, or whatever? You had to usually do so many, perform so many skills, usually in threes. You had to climb three glass mountains, for example, or you had to do this and do that. You had to perform these things in order to be successful, you remember? And usually, what usually happened along the way as the person was trying to perform these tasks?
Evil character would come
Yeah. Evil would be there somewhere, that's right, and kind of foul up the thing. And sometimes animals would help out Lester, and sometimes they're good animals, and sometimes they're bad animals. Well, that's what Tolkien's got. He's got animals in this book that talk and that do things, and they are sometimes good and sometimes bad. A lot of times when you first talk about Tolkien, people, they kind of scratch their head and say, oh, animals that talk? I don't know if that's for me. Then you find out there's wizards in there and orcs, and you say, what's an orc? And I say, well, it's an ugly critter. I'll tell you, orc is bad news from the word go. And then there's elves, and when you say elves, that's it. They walk out and say, no, I don't want elves. And the hobbits are bad enough right off the bat. Well, they got all these people and some others, all kinds of folk in here. And people say, you mean it's fantasy literature? No, not quite fantasy literature, although it partakes of fantasy. So was it science fiction? I said, no, not science fiction at all. Is it escapist literature? I said, oh, no. I've had people, other professors, put this down because they say it's escapist, and it's not escapist at all, in my opinion. I don't know how the rest of you feel have read it. If this is escapist literature, then that's the only kind of literature for me, because I rank Tolkien with the greatest writers of all time, and I would unashamedly put these books in the top 10 works of literature, period. And that's with a lot of big, along with Shakespeare and Chaucer and Dante and the boys. I think he's that good. But you do have elves in there. You have hobbits. You have goblins. Wolf riders. Don't let me scare you off now. So it's a bag, okay? The ants. Oh, yeah. Yes. All the Tolkien lovers. Yes. Tom Bombadil. See, there's great folk in here waiting for ants or trees. You can look out at these woods at night, and if you've got a super imagination, you can just imagine there must be ants groaning and weaving and their roots gnarling. Ants are tree-like things who are shepherds who watch over the other trees who are just trees. But I, there's no way I can explain that except just what I've done. The rest is up to you to read. This is one of those rare books that can't be explained away. And it can't really be taught. I tried to teach it two or three times where I teach at Cal Lutheran, the Thousand Oaks. I tried to teach it at the University of Nebraska. I wind up with students just kind of putting their heads back and say, oh, yeah, read to me. don't discuss it. Just they break out their cookies and milk and they expect it. So that's fair. I did it. It's great. Okay, in a quest, you have companions. Usually, there are any number of people or things who go along with the quest as helpers. But traditionally, these questers or helpers fall off somewhere. As things get rough and as time goes, they one by one, they leave the quester until finally, the quester is out on the edge of the frontier doing it by himself. An American quester would be James Natty Bumpo. What's his face? Long leather stocking. Hawkeye, yeah, Daniel Boone, but I'm thinking, right, I'm trying to think, what's his name? Hawkeye, okay. No, well, then, yeah, Davy Crockett, that's another one. Yeah, it's his character, well, Hawkeye is his name, it seems he had another name. But anyway, Hawkeye is a quester, he's out at the edge of the frontier. He and his two Indian companions, right, Chingachgook and Uncas, and they live on the edge of the frontier. Sometimes the quester runs afoul of law because the quester is on the edge. And sometimes laws don't pertain to the quester. He's the guy who's getting his nose bent out of shape all the time because he's out there forging ahead. Questers sometimes are getting lots of problems. And society doesn't understand them. Usually it's the quester who's opening up the new frontier and is making things safe or different for the people who will come by. Little Hawkeye would be up in upstate New York, right in the lakes, in the Indians, and then the people read the rest of the Leatherstocking Tales, and the people come into their axes, they chop down all these beautiful trees, and Hawkeye and his Indians slept under, and they put up a village. They put up, the first thing he used, put up a jail. The first thing he used, throw Hawkeye in. So he takes off and starts a new life, and society keeps creeping up on him. The quester keeps going. Walt Whitman was a quester. Song of Myself is a great quest poem. Anyway, and so in here, the helpers that are going to help Frodo deliver this ring back where it was made fall off one by one until poor Frodo is out there by himself. The quester is usually wounded, as I said, and can't enjoy the fruits of his quest. And Frodo suffers a grave wound. He must leave his home and take the road without being sure of his destination. And that's one of the grabbers of this kind of a book. It's a book of the road. And that speaks to a Jungian archetype in all of us. We all have this built-in road syndrome. And this is a great place to read Tolkien up here, because you look down the road and you look up at those paths and the trails going off into the different valleys and mountains, and you say, right. Let me shoulder my pack and grab my staff, and I'll deliver that ring. Nothing I can't do. Okay, so much for the quest, which is kind of brief. Gandalf is a very bright wizard, okay? And he's been around a long time. And years ago, way back in Middle Earth, Bilbo, whose birthday we celebrate September 22nd, along with his nephew Frodo, same day, has come by this ring. And I won't go into that because it's a neat story and you need to do it on your own. But he has the ring and he's not quite sure what it does. He knows that he can put it on and disappear. That's kind of neat, but he doesn't know the history. Gandalf appears at an interesting time when Frodo has decided he's going to hang it up in the Shire in Hobbiton. And the hobbits live in the hills, in little burrows. And he says, I'm going to hang it up, and I'm getting to be an old hobbit, and I'm going to go live with the elves in Rivendell and some of the half-elves. And he takes in Frodo, his nephew, and says, my hole is yours, and all my goods, I'm leaving. And here's a ring. Watch out for it. And that's all he says, and he takes off. And throws a great big birthday party, and right in the middle of it slips on his ring, and everybody goes bananas. And because they don't like hobbits, you have adventures. So Bilbo has always been a little suspect. He has money. He's been on adventures. Got to watch out for folks like that. Right? Yes, the Took Blood. Yes. Right. Got to watch the Took Blood. It'll will show every time. So Frodo has the ring, and Gandalf appears to him and tells him the history of the ring. And says, it's bad news, Frodo. It's really bad news. It was made by, and Gandalf kind of looks around, Sauron. And then the clouds cover the sky. And Frodo says, Sauron? What's that? Well, that's the evil. There's an evil in the book, and one of the names, his name is Sauron. Evil can't really have a name, or it can have too many names, right? Either way. And this ring, a lot of rings were made, and one ring particularly to rule them all. And old Sauron is working on getting these rings kind of discovered and laying them out, controlling things, but the one ring has eluded him. He says, if I can get that one ring back, the Big Daddy ring, it's all over for the good folks. And Frodo has it. And Gandalf says it's got to be destroyed because war is coming. One of the great things that Tolkien does, in addition to the Song of the Open Road, which he does beautifully, is this idea of imminent danger. You can hardly read a chapter in Tolkien where you just think something is about to jump out and grab you. He has things called Nine Riders, which are evil people who have come under the influence of Sauron because of the rings. He has all kinds of the stones, the dead marshes, rocks, morasses, glaciers, mountains, mines, like Holden Mine. There's all kinds of things that seem about to womp on you. And that's a great strain, Tolkien, and like nobody else that I know of. The other thing that Tolkien does better than anybody else is names. Those of you who read, you know what I mean. The names he gives people, the names he gives, let's play with some names just for a minute or two. What are some names of some hills or mountains or rivers or people?
In the
Mordor.
Mordor.
Mordor is where Sauron lives, and the name of his tower is Barad-dûr. Sounds evil right off the bat. Where the elves live is Rivendell, which is a Shangri-La kind of place. And the home of the elves is what? Where Celeborn and Galadriel live. The king and queen of the elves are Celeborn and Galadriel. What beautiful names. Lothlorien. Lothlorien. And the river Celebrant runs through there. And all these names are just
Mirkwood.
Right. Mirkwood. Mirkwood is a forest. And it's murky. Dark, bad things happening there. Mirkwood.
What's the name of the dragon?
And the goblins.
Smog.
There's a dragon called Smog, S-M-A-U-G. And the goblins have common names like Bill and Tom. Yeah. It's interesting, the goblins, these hideous things, have these dumb names, right?
The rider.
Strider.
Strider.
Strider. Strider. Strider. Strider. Strider. Strider. All right, now we're cooking.
Oh.
All right. Yes, watch his name, that's right. Because somebody grows 6 feet and takes on Peter O'Toole's characteristics when the wind is right. Shelob is a great big fat old spider who loves nothing better than sting unwary orcs that come into her domain. Okay, these are some of the things you're dealing with. He has marshes that are called dead marshes. Oh, yes, and then there's an evil little character who makes Iago look like a choir boy named Gollum. And Gollum is a sort of hobbit gone bad, and he had the ring, and Bilbo got it away from him in an interesting little story you'll read about in The Hobbit. And Gollum has gone evil. He doesn't like the sun. He doesn't like people. He wants that ring, my precious, he calls it. And he spends 3 books, which, by the way, is longer than War and Peace. So if you don't like large novels, stay away from this one. But when you start, don't stop unless you get to page 100. I've had a lot of my friends that have read up page 90 or so, and I say, gee, Jack, I can't do it anymore. I understand that, because up to page 90 or 100, you're just shifting gears. But once you get to 100 or so, it's all over. You can't put it down. All right. Okay. So Frodo says, you know, I've got to take this ring back. Gandalf says, yeah, you're the man. Now, Frodo is an unassuming little hobbit. And this is one of the things that pertain to folk tale and fairy tale literature of the quest. You remember when the king in the fairy tales has got 3 sons, right? And which son is it that's going to have to do the thing? The youngest son, the guy who's always out whittling and whistling and kind of a ne'er-do-well, and his father, the king, says, oh, geez, he'll never make anything of himself. For some reason, the first number one son and number two son are either pompous asses or they screw up somewhere. And it's the young son who gets the job done. The most unlikely, and even in Shakespeare, is not above that. A King Lear, for example, which daughter is it that gets the shaft from a beautiful person? The third one, what's her name?
Cordelia?
Yeah, and the other two are Goneril and Regan, and they are mean women. And it's the third girl. So you always have this number 3 pertaining in one way or another. Either 3 quests you must do, or 3 people. And it's the unassuming. King Arthur, yeah. Who is it that sees the Holy Grail? Lancelot, pure of heart, innocent, unassuming. He says, who, me? The Holy Grail, you know, the chalice, can only be seen by the pure of heart. So all through, pardon? Yeah, what's his name, Alyosha?
Yeah,
okay, so you have this thing, this theme running through literature, and it's an archetype, and it appeals to whatever is buried, as Jung would say in our collective unconscious, it's there. You put all these things together, and you've got a book that's dynamite. And then he creates names, he creates languages, he has a language of the men, language of orcs, a language of elves, a language of goblins, just all kinds of languages.
His genealogies, too.
Genealogies, in the back of the book, the appendices number something like 200 pages just of notes. So what we're dealing with here is a magnum opus of the first caliber. This guy, Tolkien, is one of the best, greatest scholars. If you can imagine people like Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and W.H. Auden, the great poet, getting together for lunch over in Oxford and sitting around dunking their tea bags and saying, well, C.S., read us a little Narnia. What are you working on? And he'd read a little and say, well, Jerry, what are you reading? Oh, I'm doing this thing on the Hobbits. Well, what's that? And he'd read a little, and then Auden would read one of his new, can you imagine a trio like that? Over tea? Great. Well, yes. And now they're all dead. Yeah. Not too long ago. One thing I want to say about this is that the allegory that you read in here, you read into yourself. And it's almost impossible to not read allegory in. Tolkien himself said there's no allegory. I wrote a story about things called, people called hobbits, doing an adventure on the road, and that's it. Okay, but nobody listens to it because it's so interesting and easy to read in the allegory. The allegory of pure evil against pure good, and what happens? What wins? And he's written an honest novel, an honest book, because this is not fantasy. If you're the pure good, you're on the hobbit side, you're trying to take this ring back and destroy it before it can destroy all of Middle Earth, and you step off a cliff, you're going to smash yourself. Tolkien says, all the laws of nature pertain. You can't play any favorites. So the good guys get smashed over and over again. But it is a tremendous novel of the will to succeed and the will to do what's right, which is the hardest thing in the world to do.
Where do the hobbits get their values from? They believe in God, for example?
No, there's no mention of God.
Do they have any central sort of godlike or divine figure?
Only in the dim past, in lore, in hobbit lore, but they don't call it God. It's a god figure. It's kind of an over Emersonian oversoul is what it really is, but they don't use those terms either. No, they get their values from sitting down at the tavern in the pub and smoking pipeweed and telling stories and passing on the lore of the Peregrines and the Tooks and the Brandybucks and all the hobbits. And when it gets dark outside and they see the lights twinkling off and hobbits, and it's time to go home. And they talk about the people on the other side of the Brandywine River, which is maybe about 12 miles away, but that's in a different country, and you watch out for folks who are 12 miles away because they do things. And that's where their values come from. It's just like being on the farm was growing up in Southern Illinois. It wasn't a matter of Bible or God or anything. It was just a matter of passing down story after story after story until finally you're too scared to do anything to be good for a while. That sort of thing. Well, to make a long story longer, Frodo is off on this journey. He must destroy the ring. And a very powerful man goes with him on the journey. His name is, he's called Strider. He's a ranger. The rangers are guys who kind of walk around the hill. They're like John Moccasins, always in the mountains. And they're making Holden Village safe. And you may get up in the morning and eat and drink and go to sleep here and not think anything of it, but they're really guys in these mountains watching the borders. People come, the bad guys from Trinity, they turn back. And they don't just let anybody know. That's what Aragorn was doing. His name is Aragorn, and he's a prince. He's the son of a prince, of a prince, of a prince. And he has great names. And that's another thing that Tolkien does so well. He has a tremendous Old Testament thunderous prose at his fingertips. You know, in the Old Testament, so-and-so, son of so-and-so, begat, so-and-so, son of begat. He does the same thing with these beautiful names. And at various times, he parades this beautiful language when Aragorn was suddenly, at the drop of a cloak, stand up and reveal himself in his princely majesty and say, I am Aragorn, son of Arathorn, son of so, this is my blade, this is my shield. And he goes through this Homeric list of things, and everybody kind of drops back in awe and amazement because he's suddenly revealed in his glory. Then he picks up his elven cloak and puts him around his old Strider again, and off he goes. Well, Tolkien likes to have fun, I think, with lines like that once in a while. But it's kind of neat. Let me read you a couple of examples. You'll find the same kind of language in Moby Dick, in some of those great chapters where Melville just thunders along, you know, where Ahab and Ishmael are really clashing over whether Moby Dick is a fish, or I mean, just a whale, or is he the great gliding demon of the depths, as says Ahab, which is what kills Ahab and why Ishmael doesn't care. He looks over and says, oh, it's a fish. Mm-hmm. Ahab says, it's a whale and I must have him, so he doesn't know. Some of this language. Oh, I was going to read you a little description of the hobbits. Since some of you haven't read the book, you might be interested in this brief description of them. Of course, I just gave you a brief description, didn't I? Oh, rat's rears. I brought the wrong book. I found it. Yes. Hobbits are an unobtrusive but very ancient people, more numerous formerly than they are today. And you probably noticed that, but you've been here so many days and you probably haven't seen any. For they loved peace and quiet and good tilled earth. A well-ordered and well-farmed countryside was their favorite haunt. They do not and did not understand or like machines more complicated than forge bellows, a water mill, or a hand loom, though they were skillful with tools. Even in ancient days, they were as shy of the big folk, as they call us. And now they avoid us with dismay and are becoming hard to find. They are quick of hearing and sharp-eyed, and though they are inclined to be fat and do not hurry unnecessarily, they are nonetheless nimble and deft to movements. Okay. The smaller dwarves, stout and stocky. They dressed in, pardon? Yes. Oh, yes. They dressed in bright colors, being notably fond of yellow and green. They seldom wore shoes, since their feet had tough, leathery soles, and were clad in thick, curling hair, much like the hair of their heads, which is commonly brown. Thus, the only craft little practiced among them was shoemaking. But they had long and skillful fingers and could make many other useful, skillful things. Their faces, as a rule, were good-natured rather than beautiful, broad, bright-eyed, red-cheeked, with mouths apt to laughter and to eating and drinking. And laugh they did, and eat, and drink, often heartily, being fond of simple jests at all times and 6 meals a day when they could get them. They were hospitable and delighted in parties and in presents which they gave away freely and eagerly accepted. So how could you not love a hobbit, right? Take one home with you.
I thought the description was probably in there with halflings.
Halflings, yes.
Halflings.
Right, that's right. The big people call them halflings. They don't know what hobbits are. Okay. Is the wind coming up? It's a good time to read Tolkien. Oh, that's a truck. There's the classical and the romantic right there. You bet. Yes. The Apollonian and the weather thing. Whatever. Thank you. Let's not forget turns. Okay, they're setting out on their journey. They've got their packs. I love the part where they shoulder the packs. It always gets to me. They got their little staves, and they take off, and they're hiking up in the hills. They turn around with the last lights going, and back to Hobbiton, where they spent all their lives. And as they began to climb its first slopes, they looked back and saw the lamps in Hobbiton far off, twinkling in a gentle valley of the water. Soon it disappeared in the folds of the darkened land and was followed by Bywater beside his gray pool. When the light of the last farm was far behind, peeping among the trees, Frodo turned and waved a hand in farewell. "I wonder if I shall ever look down into that valley again," he said quietly. When they had walked for about 3 hours, they rested. The night was clear, cool, and starry, but smoke-like wisps of mist were creeping up the hillsides from the streams and deep meadows. Thin-clad birches, swaying in a light wind above their heads, made a black net against the pale sky. See, that's beautiful descriptive passages in here. It makes you want to hike all the time. Well, the black riders are after Frodo right from the beginning, and these are evil spirits that really cannot be seen because they're clothed in black. But if Frodo puts on his ring, he can see them, and he's not supposed to do that, but he does. And they're after him because they want the ring, and they mean to have it, and they almost get it.
Can you tell them the effect of putting on the ring?
Disappear.
Repeatedly.
Repeatedly, you start to thin. You age. Bilbo lived to be a very old hobbit, partially because he had the ring too much. And you start to thin, you almost become transparent. You don't actually, but you have almost a thinning, like the atoms are somehow breaking apart from each other, and you're almost like, if you think of the stars at night, like a Whitman kind of a cosmic idea of reaching your hand up to the stars, and suddenly you can't see your hand anymore. All of a sudden you look in your palm, and there's a star. And you look down your arm, and there's a Milky Way, and you realize you've become the universe. That's spooky, right? That's the resurrection. That's the way I think of the resurrection, of Jesus just suddenly... And there he is. Okay. There's one time they're holed up on top of this mountain, and the black riders are after them. And, "Hush," whispered Strider. "What's that?" gasped Pippin at the same moment. I love those gasps. Tolkien uses language that you don't use a lot anymore, which is another reason I like it. He has favorite words. One of his favorite words is fell, a fell glance, F-E-L-L. You don't use that anymore, do you? You use that lately? You have a fell glance. You know that? No, you don't use it. But he does. Fell, which means awful. Over the lip of a little dell on the far side away from the hill, they felt, rather than saw, a shadow rise, one shadow or more than one. They strained their eyes, and the shadow seemed to grow. Soon there could be no doubt. 3 or 4 tall black figures were standing there on the slope looking down on them. So black were they that they seemed like black holes in the deep shade behind them. Frodo thought that he heard a faint hiss as of venomous breath and felt a thin, piercing chill. Then the shapes slowly advanced. Terror overcame Pippin and Merry, and they threw themselves flat on the ground. They're always doing that. Pippin and Merry are Frodo's buddies who decided to go with him, and they're forever throwing themselves, casting themselves on the ground. Sam shrank. Sam is the gardener. I forgot to introduce Sam. Sam is a faithful gardener, always sitting around listening to Frodo and Gandalf have these interesting discussions. And when Gandalf says, "Frodo, you've got to go," there's old Sam. He's got his bag packed, and he says, "If you go, Master Frodo, Sam's going." And Sam turns out to be one of the most heroic people in all of literature. He's just a grand guy, because he'd do anything for Frodo, and vice versa. Like, they make a great team. Well, he was quaking as if with bitter cold, but his terror was swallowed up in a sudden temptation to put on the ring. The desire to do this laid hold of him, and he could think of nothing else. Well, then he does slip it on. Frodo does. Immediately, though everything else remained as before, dim and dark, the shapes became terribly clear. He was able to see beneath their black wrappings. There were five tall figures, two standing on the lip of a dell, three advancing. In their white faces and keen and merciless eyes, under their mantles were long gray robes. Upon their gray hairs were helms of silver. He was able to see beneath their black wrappings. There were five tall figures, two standing on the lip of Del, three advancing. In their white faces burned keen and merciless eyes. Under their mantles were long gray robes. Upon their gray hairs were helms of silver. In their haggard hands were swords of steel. Their eyes fell upon him and pierced him as they rushed toward him. Desperate, he drew his own sword, and it seemed to him that it flickered red as if it were a firebrand. Two of the figures halted. The third was taller than the others. His hair was long and gleaming, and on his helm was a crown. In one hand he held a long sword, and in the other a knife. Both the knife and the hand that held it glowed with pale light. He sprang forward and bore down on Frodo. That's all you get for now. You don't want to tell you about that, right? So all the way along on this journey, as the true quest, he has the problem of trying to get away from these people and still trying to do right. And I can't think of anybody better to celebrate anybody's birthday. Lincoln and Washington and some others, and Frodo and Bilbo, because they represent that tremendous questing spirit that you really find hold of. You're out here in the middle of the Cascades and these tremendous peaks around here, and it seems like everybody comes up here, no matter what kind of things you were doing back in, quote, the real world, which is really not true. This is the real world. You take out a new breath. You become almost a new person, right? And when you go back down to the low country, you feel that almost a sudden shock of disappointment. I remember the first time we were up here and then went back and camped in a KOA campground in Leavenworth. And all these trailers, right? And somebody was playing rock music, and I said, no, turn it off. Quiet in the jacuzzi after 10:30. They kind of look at me, what is with you? And it's ugly, but it's not ugly. It's just different than, right? Okay. What's ugly in a way? Anyway, these are great guys to celebrate. Let me read you something about the language. This Old Testament name, where Tolkien loves to have one name, and one name will never do. He's going to have four or five names, so he's never satisfied. In one section of the second book, they are being besieged by orcs, the bad guys, and they take a narrow cleft in the mountains, which is called Helm's Deep, and this kind of runs back up into their caves leading off. There's a stream running out there, and years and years ago, they've built a great big Omar-type wall across here to keep the bad guys out and the good folk in. So they've taken trying to reach that safety in the mountains. And this is what how he describes that. And listen for the nouns. Listen to the language. At Helm's Gate, before the mouth of the deep, there was a heel of rock thrust outward by the northern cliff. There upon its spur stood high walls of ancient stone, and within them was a lofty tower. Men said that in the far-off days of the glory of Gondor, the sea kings had built here this fastness with the hands of giants. The Hornburg, it was called, for a trumpet sounded upon the tower, echoed in the deep behind, as if armies long forgotten were issuing to war from caves beneath the hills. A wall, too, the men of old had made from the Hornburg to the southern cliff, barring the entrance to the gorge. Beneath it, by a wide culvert, the deeping stream passed out. About the feet of the horn rock it wound, and flowed then in the gully through the midst of the wide green gore, sloping gently down from Helm's Gate to Helm's Dyke. Thence it fell into the deeping coombe and out into the Westfold Vale. There in the Hornburg at Helm's Gate, Erkenbrand, master of Westfold, on the borders of the Mark, now dwelt. Isn't that great language? I remember the first time I read that, I didn't understand a thing he was talking about, because you really have to read it more than once, I think, to really get into it. And I've had students read it seven. I had one guy in Nebraska who read it 17 times. He's forever saying, you made a mistake there. And I said, all right, he set me straight. So finally, I called this guy up, and I said, sit right here. We're going to go through this. But he really had the straight skinny on this stuff. But the first time I read it, it was like reading Gerard Manley Hopkins. A lot of Hopkins poems I don't understand, but I love the language. I love the sound of the words. A deeping stream, a deeping coombe, and a westfold vale. Say, ooh, that's neat. I don't know what deeping coombe was. But I didn't stop to say, oh, I can't read this because I don't know what a deeping coombe was. But it's just the language, the beautiful roll and plunge of this language is beautiful. And why not? This is one of the foremost scholars of language in our time, in anybody's time. But that's the kind of language you got.
One man told me that he started one of those and read right straight through the night. He couldn't put that book down until he finished it. He just didn't sleep until he had it finished.
I believe it. It must have taken him a couple of days, I would think. It's a long book.
That's
a long book.
But,
yeah. It's longer by, what, 150 pages than Tolstoy's War and Peace. I don't know why I compare those two. It's because they're big books, I guess. Well, this quest finally ends up in with, without giving the book away, because I don't want to do that. I don't mind telling you how Jaws ends, but I wouldn't want to tell you about this one. There's a great gulf between Tolkien and Jaws. Although I must admit, have you seen the movie Jaws? I don't want to talk about it. The movie, I thought, was not bad. I mean, if you're really in for a mind blower, you're going to sit there and say, all right, I've had a hard day, entertain me. And sit back and not think and watch for the corny dialogue. It'll do like Towering Inferno or, you know, those.
Okay.
It's really, but the book is really bad, in my opinion. Well, anyway. The quest does come to an end successfully, and Frodo has a wound, and Frodo and Sam and the whole company are intact, almost, yes, intact, and they come back to the Shire, and the Shire has run amok. The bad guys are there, and Frodo says, you mean I've been gone, what was he, 18 months? I've come back, and he's traveled over 1,200 miles to give you some idea of this, of the world he's created. Yeah.
One article that likened that unto Moses.
Yeah.
Who was a questioner and
yeah.
Came down from the mountain Sinai with the Ten Commandments
yeah.
and everything had gone
amok. Yeah.
And he also was denied.
Yeah, that's right. And Frodo can come back and does come back, but he can't stay long. He doesn't stay long. And I don't want to go into that because it's a spoiler for you. But it's a very sad commentary that sometimes the questers, the people who have to put it on the line, as Hemingway said, if you don't put your life on the line once in a while, it's not worth much. Of course, I don't know how much credence you want to put into Hemingway. He was always a chest pounder anyway. Faulkner used to say nuts to that. And anyway, Frodo comes back and eventually passes into the Grey Havens, which is a sort of transcendental death transfiguration kind of thing, which I really can't describe because I don't understand it after reading it lots of times. I'm not sure I want to understand it. I'm not sure I want to understand heaven. I can remember still being disappointed when I was in Good Shepherd Lutheran School of Mr. Uppelman telling me how many pearls and gold and how I was going to love it. And I thought, yuck. I said, can I take my dog? And he said, you can't take your dog. So I made up my mind I wasn't going. And then I read Walt Whitman, A Song of Myself, where Whitman says, the running blackberry would adorn the parlors of heaven. And I got all turned on again for heaven. I thought, all right, if heaven's going to have running blackberry bushes, I'm going. If it's going to have Railroad Creek running down the middle of it, where John Baptist and I go down and throw rocks at rats and tell good stories, then I want to go. That's the kind of feeling, the kind of mood you have within Tolkien. I've been in discussions where people want to know, is it Christian? I don't even like that question, but I wouldn't dodge it. I might dodge it because I think of it. I'll let somebody else tackle that one. It's not explicitly or overtly Christian, although I can't think of a more Christian attitude than Frodo and Sam display, can you? Of helping your neighbor and helping the other guy up the mountain when it gets tough. Yeah, if this book is not Christian, then I don't know what Christian means. It's Christian for me. It's a great adventure, and you have all the stereotypes there, the stereotype evil, you have stereotype good, you have the quest, you have the helpers, and these great names, you have 1,200 miles he covers over 18 months or whatever it is, with bleeding feet and bleeding hands. The walk up Mount Doom, this great volcano where the ring must, and the only place the ring can be destroyed. You have Christ imagery. Usually I don't even get into that. I mean, Billy Budd and books like that, you can see the Christ figures, but you see Christ figures, Frodo becoming a Christ figure, and he takes on the wound, he walks up the mountain, he's on his hands and knees, Sam gets under and carries the cross. I mean, it's just, the whole book is full of allegory, and then you read the preface and Tolkien says, no allegory intended. Well, I think, as a writer, I think you, I would go for Tolkien and say, if he says no allegory, don't take it allegorically. Then in lieu aside to the audience, just say, go ahead. Because sometimes writers are the last people to know what they intended. As you know, there's a lot of things bubbling up in the old psyche that comes out and say, I didn't mean that. And the reader says, sure you did. And there's that great paradox in art. Only the author knows what it's about, and paradoxically, only the reader knows what it's truly about. And are you ready for a third paradox? Only the thing created knows what it's really about. And the work of art, whether it be music, sculpture, a dance, poetry, whatever, exists somewhere between the creator and the person who touches it, listens to it, feels it, or hears it. And the thing created is spinning right in the middle, giving off sparks, and says, I won't tell all of me. I'll give the creator a little of it, and I'll give the reader a little of it, but the thing itself has a life all its own, and that's what makes great literature for me. Is that right? Great painting, great music, is that something you can get a hold of a little bit, but you can't own it. But you can kind of feel the vibes, the warmth, and that's what this book does. And that's what Quest literature generally does, because the Quest is archetype. Because each one of us is a questor. Because Lawrence said we have, he called the soul, this little bit of chipped off brilliance. And we do have the soul, right? We are sons, daughters of God. We are questing. Our own lives are quests. And when you read Tolkien, you say, right on, I'm right there. I've got your pack. Onward, with that ring, we can do it. And you can conquer. And that's why it's a great book. And that's why we celebrate the birthday up here. And that's why I wish I could be here to celebrate. Hey, those of you who've read, in a little time we got left, I'll let you people go eat. Oh, we got tons of time. The rest of you, why don't you chime in and bring up some things that I've neglected and why you like it and some things you see in the book that you've read into it. Anything.
What did you think about when, down in Moria?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
When Gandalf falls into the deep with the Balrog?
Yes. I just about cried. Yeah. There's a grown man, 40 years old, should know better, a tear coming. I said, let her come. For those of you who haven't read the book, there's a big mountain they have to climb with glacier on top of it, like, what's his face?
Bonanza
over here. And they can't get over it. The mountain just won't have it. And so, well, Gandalf says, I don't want to tell you this, but there's one other way. We can go through Holden Mine. So they go into this mine where years ago dwarves have built beautiful things, but long ago they uncovered the nameless terror. And that's another neat thing of Tolkien. He's got tons of nameless terrors in there. And you just got to, ooh, I don't want those. You know, he doesn't name them, but you know you wouldn't like him if he did. So they go through the mine, and Gandalf the Grey Wizard takes gas right there. He buys it, bites the bullet, and that's all you're going to hear about that, because I don't want to spoil it for you. It's beautiful. Beautiful stuff. What else?
If you read The Hobbit first, you only get a sort of prelude to the whole story, and it's a very simple prelude, and you get the idea that this is just a children's kind of fun fairy tale.
Yeah.
And you may get to the, you know, it's fun reading, but you know there's no no more substance to it than magic.
Yeah.
But you
don't
need
The Hobbit. You don't need The Hobbit to get into it. A lot of people have seen the four books and they start with The Hobbit and they say, gee, this is not what you said it was. Well, I personally started with The Rings when I was all through. Then I went back and read The Hobbit, and that was better for me. Every person is different, but that was neat for me. That's because I used to write term papers like that, I think. I could never come up with a controlling purpose or an outline. I always wrote the paper. Then I said, oh, is that what I want to say? Then I went back and made my outline to fit it. And teachers say, that's not the way you do it. Well, it worked for me that way. It does. Yeah. It does set the stage. Oh, yeah. It gives you background information. But if you don't read The Hobbit, the first chapter, the prelude or preface in The Rings will give you everything in summary anyway, so you'll have a pretty good gist of what's gone before. But not everything. The Hobbit gives a lot of stuff.
If anybody here from Seattle or the Seattle area, the UW Drama Department is giving the play The Hobbit this fall.
Oh,
where?
It was given two times this summer, and I missed both of those. And so then I called, and she said, well, we'll be doing it again this fall at the university.
At the university?
I believe that students. Scenery
stuff. One thing that frustrated me in his books were his maps were not specific enough for me. I'm sort
in the
of
books?
Spatially oriented.
Yeah.
And when I tell about a place, I was always turning back to the map and trying to find the route. And then what I was looking for wasn't there.
It's rough. Yeah, not big. There are Tolkien calendars and there are Tolkien banners and posters.
Yeah.
some of which were actually drawn by Tolkien and the others by other. Now they're getting, it's kind of, the last Tolkien calendar I saw was, it's running amok. They start coming out with Tolkien bathrobes and stuff, it's all over. Don't let them do that. Walt Disney has the rights to make the movie, and they're hanging back because they don't want to blow it. And they don't know whether they want to make an animated movie or a real movie or a combination of animation and real people. But they're going to come out with a movie, and they're really being careful because they know they've got a classic here, and they don't want to set themselves back 100 years because all the Tolkien fans will come out of the woodwork and say, wait a minute. It's probably impossible to capture any tone of a good novel in a movie. Hollywood just screws it up almost. Once in a while, they'll come out. Dr. Zhivago, I thought, was a really pretty decent film off the book, and some other things. But Disney has the potential to do the best job. But they're really being careful. What else? About names? The songs? The books? Well, the songs. Yeah. Little poems. Yeah. And they've been set to music by Donald Swan, which I think is kind of wretched, some of them. Some of them are good, some of them are wretched. Yeah. I'm not a Donald Swan fan, that's the problem.
Where does the Two Towers fit in?
The book is just one book, and the publisher said, let's divide it here and here and here. It's like Thomas Wolfe wrote one novel, and the publisher said, let's divide it into four parts.
Oh,
starting
is it one of the
yeah, right.
Off.
It's just a continuous journey. But the subplots start entering in. The company breaks up, and all of a sudden these people are having their own subplots, and Tolkien so completely enmeshes you in the subplot, you forget about Frodo and Sam. All of a sudden he jumps back, oh yeah, there they are.
Yeah.
And then pretty soon these guys, and then it all ties in at the end. These spokes come together, and it's beautiful, and it really hums.
Well, I'm wondering kind of where their female hobbits come in.
I didn't want to tell you this, Jen, but the one female that you ever hear about is bad news, right?
Yeah,
Mobilia?
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah, the Queen of the Elves is good people.
You've got Tom Bombadil's wife.
Tom Bombadil's wife, or
yes.
Mistress, or girlfriend, or whatever. Goldberry, yeah, she's Goldberry, super. She doesn't say much, Jan. She fetches dinner for him, and right?
Watership Down is somewhat of a classic too, but it has a terrible image.
This isn't got a terrible image. I don't think
no.
there isn't much of one, but
no.
it's not terrible.
It's
the whole hospitality thing is a thread that goes through northern folklore anyway, and it's behind all of us. It isn't something
that's right. And if you want to get into a good book, there's two or three good books on the market about how the rings were made. And you can trace the names and the characters to Icelandic literature and all kinds of literature and come up with where he found this name and I borrowed this. It's like Shakespeare. He borrowed everything. Yeah, he gives the women not a whole bunch. He's not anti,
but
it's just not...
there's not much there, but it's beautiful what you got through all that.
But
it isn't the warm, cozy places. He created the warm, cozy places. He kind of his eyes over them.
In Hobbiton? The Hobbits.
It's like Frodo was, or Bilbo was a bachelor.
Bachelor.
Yeah. Boy, did he have a larder.
Frodo's a bachelor. Sam finally gets married. I don't want to get into that. What else can you chip in? Teachers have asked me when to introduce it, and I think introduce it when it works. Rule of thumb. I guess if you had to have a rule of thumb, fifth grade is you can start in the fifth grade with a Hobbit, maybe even earlier, but fifth grade for sure, and go on up. I think Narnia works better with fifth grade and maybe lower. But I've never been a great Narnia fan, I must admit, because I read Tolkien first. I think if you read Tolkien first, Narnia can sometimes be a little bit on the... Although the Narnia fans will go at my jugular for that, because they, and rightfully so.
When my son was in the third grade, he went to the Learning Resource Center at school, and Hobbit was on tape, and he listened to it, although I didn't know it at the time. Almost 2 years later, he saw me reading the book. He told me the whole story. And I couldn't believe he'd remembered it for 2 years, but we'd never talked about it. I didn't even know he'd heard it.
That's the kind of thing you won't forget.
But from third grade.
Can you remember how many books and things you've done that you know you'll never forget? Very, very few. Most things you forget, right? School, everything else, forget it. But there are once in a while things that, because they appeal to the archetypes, the things that are chipped off inside every one of us, and he plugged into that, and boy, he hit it on the nail. So when September comes around, September 22nd, wherever you are, remember that Frodo and Bilbo lives in Holden and lots of other places, and celebrate.
Yeah.